I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming right up, the Pope has sent a signal that the church sex abuse scandal will be on his agenda when he lands today in the U.S. But first, some news. Unions, politicians, and antitrust regulators are all that stand between Northwest and Delta Airlines in their proposed merger. The $3.6 billion deal agreed to by the boards of both airlines last night would create the world's largest airline. Called Delta, it would be based in Atlanta and have 89,000 workers. The planned merger comes at a time when skyrocketing fuel prices and a struggling economy have forced several other airlines to shut down or declare bankruptcy. Micheline Maynard is with the New York Times. She joins us now. And Mickey, how is this news reverberating throughout the industry?
I think this is the first domino tipping over, and I really think in the next month or so we could see more merger announcements. One of the reasons that we would see that is that the airlines want to get their mergers approved before the Bush administration is over, because they don't want to take the risk of a new president and seeing these drag on as we get a new Justice Department, that kind of thing.
Well, let me stop you there. What would the questions be? Why would there be resistance to these mergers?
Well, first of all, there will be jobs lost, and there will be cities that lose some of their air service. And the unions are quite upset about this. You know, they've seen cuts during the bankruptcies that hit the airline industry in the earlier part of this decade, and now, especially at Northwest and Delta, there'll be probably thousands of jobs lost. Both companies are saying they're not setting out to do that, but that just naturally happens in a merger. You'll see cities, some of the smaller hub cities like Cincinnati and Memphis, could lose some of their service. So there'll be a lot of people that are upset by this. They file objections with the Justice Department, and Northwest and Delta are estimating 6 to 8 months to get this approved, and that'll take them right up until the end of fall.
Right. Well, in 2001, an attempted merger of United Airlines and U.S. Airways fell apart because of these antitrust concerns. What does it say about the industry?
Well, it says two things about the industry. First of all, that the industry never really restructured over the last couple of years when it had a chance to do so. Even though it seems like there were a lot of jobs lost and a lot of cities that lost air service, there's still more fat to cut, apparently. And the second thing is fuel prices. I remember a couple of years ago that the industry said no one can deal with $60 a barrel oil and survive, and now we're up at $100 a barrel oil, and that's forcing some significant changes.
We understand jet fuel costs even more.
Well, jet fuel has to be refined and then turned into jet fuel, so you add another $10, $20, $30 on top of that.
What does this merger, this potential merger, as you said, it's going to take months, but what does it mean for consumers, for flyers?
First of all, if you live in Atlanta, you're going to probably have great service. If you live in Minneapolis, which has been a Northwest hub city, you could see some of that hub traffic go down. We're also going to see people who were served by both Northwest and Delta probably served by one or the other.
Higher ticket prices?
Possibly. One of the things we do have is we still have low-fare airlines like Southwest and JetBlue and AirTran, and that puts pressure on the big airlines to keep their fares low. But now if we start to see some combinations involving the lower fare airlines, we could see fares go up.
Right. Well, and we've just seen a tough couple of weeks for the airlines and for flyers. American canceling more than 1,000 flights because of the FAA inspections, some airlines declaring bankruptcy. You told us that if fuel prices continue to surge, airlines will probably ground huge parts of their fleet. So it just seems like it's just a tighter situation all around.
The whole safety situation is separate from this whole merger situation, and that is another thing that's making it more unpredictable to travel. And I think when people are looking at making their summer plans, they're just going to have to build extra time and possibly extra money into what they were planning to spend.
One last thought. We mentioned some of the stumbling blocks to the merger. One is the pilots' union, each airline's union fighting to see who gets seniority, questions like that. How big of an opposition do you think that's going to be?
I think that the unions will make a lot of noise, and they have every right to bring up these issues. But even the pilots' union late last year set up a kind of a system to sort out the seniority issues. And I think the Airline Pilots Association wants to make sure that the airlines stay in business and can someday be profitable. Remember, both Northwest and Delta filed for bankruptcy on the same day in 2005, and they've just emerged from bankruptcy. So it's in the best interest of all the employees, especially the pilots, to make sure that these airlines stay in business.
Micheline Maynard, business reporter for the New York Times, on the proposed merger between Northwest and Delta that would create the largest airline in the world. Mickey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
One of the big questions ahead of today's arrival in the U.S. of Pope Benedict XVI was, would he address the clergy sex abuse scandal? American church leaders like Boston's Cardinal Sean O'Malley said they tried to impress upon the Vatican the importance of the Pope addressing the crisis. Today, during his flight, he did. The Pope said he's deeply ashamed of the scandal, pledged to make sure it won't happen again, and that pedophiles don't become priests. Jay Tolson is senior writer for U.S. News & World Report. He'll be covering the papal visit. He joins us from Washington. Jay, welcome.
Good to be here, Robin.
How do you read the Pope's statement? It's just a couple sentences, but what do you take from it?
Well, it seems to suggest that he's picked up a lot of the flak that has already been fired in recent days about what seemed to be a symbolic lapse on the part of the Vatican and on his part, which is not going to one of the cities most directly affected by this, Boston being the most obvious case, or Los Angeles. I think this is probably the first of many statements on the sex abuse scandal that will come from the Pope.
Well, and tell us more about how, you know, the American church is receiving him on that issue. Let's start with that, because you're right that there's a division in the church as to how the scandal should be viewed, progressives on one side, conservative members on another.
Yes, well, as on practically every issue that confronts American Catholics, there are strongly divided views. Of course, there are those who say that the sex abuse scandal grew out of the sorts of problems that would be expected if the church remained in its old mode and didn't follow the spirit of Vatican II and move aggressively into modernity by, among other things, allowing married priests, allowing women to enter the clergy, other ways of modernizing the church.
Allowing parishes, for instance, to choose their own priests.
Even so, and even bishops in some cases. That's one point of view. Of course, the more conservative side is the problem with the sex abuse scandal is that it grew out of the laxity and moral looseness many conservatives associate with the 60s and that permeated even the seminaries and allowed this sort of cancer to spread. And of course, many people have pointed to what this Pope has done, not only in supporting a fairly aggressive policy that was put forward by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and particularly their Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. It was a policy that many in the Vatican and many bishops from other parts of the world were very reluctant to see adopted because they thought it would be costly. But it has brought out these very unsavory matters and subjected the church to huge costs.
Well, this Pope may have backed an aggressive policy to root out abuse, but as you all know, many Catholics say he didn't do enough to recognize the impact of the scandal on them. Many of the survivors of sex abuse are going to be dogging the Pope as he travels. Robert Costello, for instance, is traveling from Boston to New York on Friday. He says he's going to protest, not pray. He plans to read the names of fellow survivors of abuse while the Pope addresses the UN on Friday. There's been talk that the Pope might meet with some victims of the scandal, but groups that have requested a visit haven't heard back. We're also hearing from the self-described vigilers. These are people who maintain vigils in churches that were slated to be closed because of the cost of the sex abuse scandal. They've just announced a national support group to help other parishes fight closure. So you say American Catholics are asking, is this a church at a crossroads or in crisis? What did you conclude?
Well, I conclude to some extent that the church is always in crisis. It's the nature of churches when they're dealing with the larger society. But this particular crisis, if you want to call it that, or critical juncture, is obviously not going to go away. There is going to continue to be a very vocal and quite well organized collection of people who are going to say that this is the number one problem and the number one item on the agenda. Voice of the Faithful, for example, a very large lay organization of Catholics who are dedicated to this issue. So it's not going to go away. But again, you have to compare this with the fact that this Pope has very high approval ratings. I mean, it's his traditional Orthodox agenda is deemed by 50% of Americans to be the right thing, whereas in 2003, two-thirds of American Catholics preferred a more modernizing program. The data is really hard to parse.
But I do want to talk about some of that data, which is what U.S. News & World Report is so good at, gathering those statistics. Tell us more about what Catholics think about their Pope. I mean, you're right, 70% of them approve of his leadership, and which is surprising because he was known as God's Rottweiler when he was a cardinal. He was the chief enforcer of church doctrine, but many have found him more moderate than they thought he would be.
Actually, the most recent poll has about 80% approving. So his approval ratings seem to be going up even as we speak. But the big prediction, particularly among people who didn't know him very well or know his writing very well, was that he was going to be a strict enforcer of doctrine when he became Pope. Of course, that's what he did in his previous office. But in his first two encyclicals, for example, he has pushed a far more sort of conciliatory, large-souled message focusing on the meaning of love and of charity. And also what those encyclicals have showed is a very clear and strong engagement with the modern world and modern thinking and the role of religion in the world. And I think, again, that's one of the reasons why he's so intrigued with America, is he is fascinated with the way America, which in many ways is the source of all the kind of popular culture and relativism that we think he abhors, but he also knows that it's a place where religion is very vibrant and where there are many religions jostling in the marketplace, you might say, and where his church has done quite well.
Right. The Catholic Church has the third highest retention rate behind only Mormons and Judaism. He's also expected to talk about global warming. He's concerned about global warming, about the cost of the war in Iraq. The church was against the invasion of Iraq. But how modern can this pope be? I'm looking at some of your other statistics. 58% believe the Catholic Church should allow women to be ordained. 63% believe the church's position against condoms is wrong. Only 17% believe abortion is morally wrong in all circumstances. Only 7% believe divorce is not acceptable in any case.
There is a growing fondness among younger Catholics, the so-called millennial generation, kids who were born after 1981. They all tend to favor far more traditionalist approaches to Catholicism. They're, in fact, more Orthodox and traditionalist than those Catholics who were born after 1963, the Vatican II. Actually, they resemble the pre-Vatican II Catholics. They will almost routinely say that they don't go along with the church's stand on condoms and birth control. At the same time, they want their church to be distinctive. They're looking for traditional elements. And a lot of times, commentators can't put together these seeming inconsistencies.
That's Jay Tolson of U.S. News and World Report. Speaking of young Catholics, what will the Pope say Thursday in his highly anticipated meeting with Catholic educators? He planned to give a speech on education in Rome last January, but students and faculty there, fearing a dogmatic harangue, forced the Pope to withdraw. So this week, will he insist that U.S. Catholic colleges tighten up on their teaching, or will he abide by the sort of separation of church and school instituted by Catholic colleges in 1967? We'll take that up after a break. Also later today, the latest from Texas on that polygamist raid. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Jay Tolson, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Before the break, Jay was telling us that many younger Catholics want modernization, therefore birth control, for instance, but they also want tradition. And Jay, you write that there's a religious order in Nashville, for instance, embracing habits for nuns, and the bishop there also bans altar girls. These are symbolic, you say, but important?
It's now fairly well established that a lot of the more traditionalist organizations within the church have more attraction to Catholics because of their traditionalism. But again, we have to look at the larger picture. That very traditional order in Nashville that has been much written about draws an unusually high number of young women, but it draws them from a national body, whereas in the past they used to draw that number of young women from the Nashville area alone. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's been a radical decline in the number of sisters in the church, and really these in many ways are the foot soldiers in the Catholic schools, Catholic hospitals. Even if traditional orders draw relatively more young women, they're not going to compensate for the overall decline.
You mentioned the young people. Pope Benedict is going to speak to Catholic college and university presidents on Thursday. That's expected to be one of the major events of the visit. Is it tied into this idea of the enthusiasm for the Catholic Church among the young?
I think what this talk is really about is two things. It takes up a theme that has been addressed by John Paul on a number of occasions during his papacy, which is a desire on his part to see the American Catholic colleges and universities to be a little more in conformity with Catholicity, the spirit of Catholicism, a little less independent. Now, ever since 1967, American Colleges and Universities, their association, have held by their Lando Lakes Charter, which was a declaration saying that American Catholic colleges and universities are independent of any secular or religious authority. The only Catholic university that is under direct control of the hierarchy is the Catholic University of America. But many church leaders and the Pope, both popes, have felt that they are too distant from the church teaching, and they would like to see some signs of consistency with Catholicism in these schools. In particular, they would like that professors of theology have some sort of approval from the local bishops so that they teach theology that is consistent with Catholic teaching, and they would like that university life reflect Catholic values. For example, do you invite pro-choice speakers onto the campus? A lot of Catholic bishops and members of the hierarchy would say, no, that's not what a Catholic school should do. So those are the kinds of issues in general that people have been talking about. The question is, will the Pope come to this group of Catholic educators and scold them? Some people say that he will, that he will ask for a more consistent set of guidelines. Others say that that's not what he's here to do at all. He will, of course, say it would be nice if some of these schools would become more consistent with Catholic teaching, but that he's mainly here to say how much he values these schools. I mean, the fact that there are 213 Catholic universities in America is astonishing, whereas in many European countries, Germany, for example, there's only one. So you can't say that Catholic education or higher education is more abundant in this country.
So it sounds as if the question of the Pope as he addresses education is whether or not he's going to mandate more Catholicity or strongly encourage it. And you write that some people who work directly with kids are hoping very much that he helps them address kids. But I'm looking at, you know, I'm looking at another graph here in U.S. News and World Report. It's fascinating. It's about changing practices in the church. You show that while far fewer young people, people born after 1981, young Catholics, for instance, go to confession yearly, it's almost, I think it's 19% as opposed to 45% of older Catholics who go to confession. Young people abstain from meat on Fridays during Lent, almost at the same percentage as older Catholics, and almost at the same percentage as older Catholics, they look forward to receiving ashes at Ash Wednesday service.
It's not completely consistent. Like, confession going is still very spotty. Anecdotally, people are saying that it is on the rise, but so far there's no real compelling data to prove that. There has been a slight uptick over a period of a few years.
Well, as we said, the Catholic Church retains its members at a terrific rate, third only to Judaism and Mormonism in the U.S. But another statistic is that more Catholics leave the religion of their childhood than members of any other church. That's a Pew Forum poll. So what is the Pope's biggest challenge in retaining young people? I mean, where is the fear that they might go?
He isn't going to come here and try to make the church sound as though it is a flexible, open, more fluid and modernizing organization, a religion. He is actually going to stand by his very traditional Orthodox teaching. He's going to emphasize the importance of religion, and particularly his religion, in not only the life of faith, but the life of reason. And he will be making, at times, a highly intellectual argument, which will be quite in contrast with his predecessor, who was much more of a kind of dramatic figure, a man of gesture, and who could really reach out and touch people, even in big crowds. This is a man who is a very careful and precise thinker who has some ideas. And I think one of the big questions is, can this kind of preacher-teacher connect with an American following as strongly as his predecessor. Many people think not.
When, in fact, the concern of some of the youth workers that you talk to is that they'll be drawn to more, you know, evangelizing churches that have rock bands and, you know, huge congregations and are appealing to young people.
Many thought that he would be too harsh in driving out people with different views. But actually, since he's become Pope, he's tried to make his traditionalism a more sort of gentle traditionalism. But he's a man who's going to stand by a very traditionalist, Orthodox Christian message.
Jay Tolson, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, who wrote extensively on the state of the Catholic Church as the Pope makes his historic visit. Jay, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And, of course, we'll continue to follow that story. Tomorrow on Here and Now, though, we're going to visit with best-selling author Jhumpa Lahiri. She's getting raves for her latest work, her latest look at the immigrant experience. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, why are more and more girls getting hurt playing sports? That's after the news, Here and Now. One of the largest child custody cases in U.S. history continues to unfold in Texas this week. A judge there is considering the cases of 416 children forcibly removed from a polygamist ranch earlier this month. The raid was the most decisive action a state has taken in more than 50 years against the breakaway Mormon sect, the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Yesterday, some women in 19th-century pioneer dresses gave rare reporter interviews at the Yearning for Zion Ranch, describing the trauma their children were going through as their sect faces allegations of child abuse.
Mother, don't hold my hand. And I says, why? Because it's child abuse. I says, no, it's not.
The April 3rd raid on the ranch in El Dorado, Texas, was triggered by a call the police say a 16-year-old made to a women's shelter in which she claimed to have been physically and sexually abused by the 50-year-old husband she was forced to marry and conceive two children with. That young woman has not been found, and church members say the call was a hoax, but police reportedly found other underage pregnant girls. Joining us on the line first, reporter Terry Langford, who's covering the story for the Houston Chronicle from San Angelo. Terry, yesterday, Texas child welfare officials moved these children and some of their mothers to a new location in a nearby coliseum. What's the status of the mothers and children now? Are they together?
Some of the women are. Any woman who had a child 4 years of age or younger had the option of staying at the coliseum, and that's about 82 of the 139. Another 57 women were told that they could go back to the ranch or to an undisclosed, quote-unquote, safe location that the state won't reveal. It's thought to be a women's shelter of some sort. Six women took that option to go to the safe location. 51 women returned to the El Dorado Ranch from San Angelo.
Well, we understand that now there's a hearing for all of the children and the mothers on Thursday. First of all, what's that for?
This is a traditional, most child service agencies have this type of hearing. It's a 14-day hearing. Basically, the state has to prove up that the children should remain in state custody, that there are several different risks or factors that compels the state to keep them in custody and away from harm. The state will be bringing some evidence of that. They are having some difficulties, though, because the children and the mothers have given different names, different ages. There are at least 20 girls that the state can't determine whether they're an adult or whether they are a child.
There's no birth certificates?
No birth certificates for these children.
Right. And the state is saying that this is, by the way, protocol for when there's allegations of abuse. They separate parents and children. Of course, the polygamists are crying foul. But tell us some of the other thorny legal questions. We understand there aren't enough lawyers.
Not enough child advocates. There's several different issues. Let me address the one about CPS. As in every state, CPS is a contention agency for parents who are under some sort of suspicion of neglect or abuse. But it is traditional and it is legal that basically when the children are taken into custody, the parents do not follow. This was a rare circumstance where the mothers decided to come. CPS didn't ask them to come, but they accommodated them for almost 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Do you want to? The other issues, though, you're talking about, the state needs is looking for 416 lawyers to represent one for each child, and they're also looking for 416 court-appointed special advocates. These are the sort of eyes and ears for the court, for the judge, who monitor the child's progress, report to the court about what is going on with that particular child.
Well, how are Texans responding to all of this?
I think Texans are no different than anyone else on this issue. There's a huge property rights issue where people don't like the state coming onto their land, and they sympathize with the church on that aspect. They sympathize with the church on the aspect that children are being taken away, and this is a large number of children. But on the same, on the different side of the coin, there are people who are horrified that if young minor girls are being allowed to have sex with adult men, and we're not talking about some 16-year-old who has a 19-year-old boyfriend. They're very horrified that that's been going on for years.
Right. That's Terry Langford. She's a reporter for the Houston Chronicle in San Angelo, Texas, covering that raid on the Yearning for Zion Ranch in El Dorado, Texas, earlier. Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And let's turn now to Jonathan Turley. Just want him to weigh in for a second. He, of course, law professor at George Washington University. Jonathan, FLDS spokesperson, their attorney, Rodney Parker, is quoted as saying that the members feel as if the system is biased against them. But, you know, the state is saying, look, we have allegations of child abuse. This isn't about polygamy. It's about child abuse. Your thoughts on the raid?
Well, I think there's arguments on both sides. But I do think that there are questions about the probable cause leading to the original raid. It generally is not considered to be sufficient probable cause to receive a phone call from an individual and to raid an entire compound and seize hundreds of children. That could cause a problem later with any criminal prosecution. They need to establish that they did have probable cause, or whatever they found might be suppressed. But that may not change the civil side. When it comes to the protection of children, the state is given a lot of deference, and the standard is what is in the best interest of the children. But, you know, I have to say it's getting very troubling in how the officials are dealing with these parents. You know, there are reports that state officials took away cell phones from the parents when they try to speak to the media, and that they have prevented efforts by some of these parents in the past to talk with media who are located around the perimeter of this confinement area. Those are really very disturbing reports.
But don't the police have cause for concern? We want to remind people that this sect is led by Warren Jeffs, who was convicted in Utah last year of being an accomplice to rape for forcing the marriage of a 14-year-old to her cousin. He's awaiting trial in Arizona. So, you know, there's a little probable cause for concern.
Well, there's cause for concern. Whether it is constitutional probable cause is something that's more in question. You can't vicariously apply criminality to everyone who follows a particular group. I'm not saying that the state is wrong in taking these children and separating them, but that level of deference quickly evaporates with time.
Well, you know, I want to raise that question with you at another time. We're probably going to revisit this story. But in the minute we have now, couldn't you say that all adult members of a sect are responsible for perpetrating child abuse if it is institutionalized in their community?
I think that's going to raise serious constitutional questions, because you're effectively banishing a religion. You're saying if you are in this religious group, you can't have children or we'll take them away. And this is a group that was subject to the Short Creek raid in July 1953. It was considered one of the abusive raids in Arizona, when hundreds of people were arrested and hundreds of children were taken, some never to be returned to their parents. And historically, that is viewed as a great abuse. The question is whether the state officials have acted with more measure here.
That's Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. We will revisit this. There are other polygamists who've been appearing on Larry King saying that they want to separate themselves from this sect as opposed to just polygamy. So it's obviously opened up a whole discussion. Jonathan, thanks, and we'll continue it.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. More more than 3 million girls currently play sports in high school, about 10 times the number in 1972, the year that Title IX law created a level playing field. That may be one reason that more girls are getting injured playing sports. But increasingly, research is showing that girls get hurt more because they are vulnerable to certain types of injuries. Syndicated health columnist Judy Foreman is writing about this in the Boston Globe. We'll link you to her story. But Judy, you write that there are a whole host of injuries that disproportionately affect female athletes, and some of it has to do with simply how women are built. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't want to claim that anatomy is destiny, but in this case, there are a few anatomical differences. Women have wider hips, which means that the angle of their muscles from their hip to their knees is wider than in men's, and that really messes up their knees. They get more ACL injuries. That's the anterior cruciate ligament, and that's, as any athlete knows, that's a nasty thing, and women get that problem four times more than men on average.
They also have tighter muscles around the lower leg?
Yep, and that leads to a thing called compartment syndrome, which is apparently incredibly painful, but your muscles just kind of rub up against the tissue that's over them.
Well, so what are some of the reasons for this disproportionate amount of knee injuries and lower leg muscle injuries? Is it the sports as well that they're playing?
No, women play a lot of different sports, but it seems to be the sports that impact your knees the most, like basketball, where you're jumping and landing and pivoting. That seems to really put a lot of torque on female knees, which are a little more vulnerable to start with.
And it's also, we understand from your column, that girls are more involved in things like cheerleading and gymnastics, which are really high-end now.
Yes. I mean, back in the old days, I was a cheerleader, and it was pretty benign. Now they're throwing each other up in the air and, you know, landing. And cheerleading actually has some fatalities. There's an interesting group in North Carolina called the Center for Catastrophic Sport Injury Research, and they have found that cheerleading is the most dangerous sport that women participate in. There are actually 43 fatal and non-fatal and serious injuries in this time period, you know, leading up to 2006. And that was the most dangerous sport by far.
Huh. So one thing to keep in mind. But there's no question that, you know, girls are getting more knee injuries. We know some researchers are training girls to defray them. There's a big study underway at Children's Hospital in Cincinnati. What are some of the ways that doctors are suggesting that you defray these injuries?
Well, a lot of it has to do with orthotics can help. Those are those little things you put in your shoes to make your there be less stretch and strain on your knees and your ankles and your hips. Training, coaching is huge. Coaches have to learn that women, you know, have to be protected against certain injuries more than men. Weightlifting is probably the most important thing. If you really do a lot of strength training to strengthen the muscle on the inside of your kneecap, that can sort of help you avoid the torque injuries on your knee.
Yeah. You spoke to one of the leaders in sports medicine, Dr. Lyle McKelly, who's here at Children's Hospital in Boston. His office is always packed with girls.
Yep, I've been there.
Me too. Girls on crutches. He recommends, for instance, when you talk about training, there's specific kind of training, for instance, teaching girls how to pivot.
Yes, he's noticed that, you know, female basketball players tend to land on one foot at turn, and men use 2 feet. And again, that may be because women's hips are wider and that, you know, affects how they land. But you could train girls to land better and twist and jump and cut, as they say in basketball, so as not to injure themselves.
This is the kind of research that's going on right
now. That's right.
Judy, while we have you, we've reported on the high rate of concussions in girls. They're 68% more likely to sustain one in high school soccer than boys, and 3 times more likely to get them when they play basketball. And their symptoms seem to last longer. You know, what's the thinking here?
Nobody really knows. It may be that girls report these injuries more often than boys, but it could also be, and again, this is speculation, that their neck muscles aren't as strong so that they can't kind of absorb the impact of falling on the ground or getting hit by another player.
So helmets when you can, I guess, for girls as well as boys.
And weight training to strengthen your neck muscles, but with a coach who really knows what she or he is doing.
Okay, that's Judy Foreman, syndicated health columnist. Again, go to here-now.org to read her essay. While we're on the topic of sports, in the wake of last week's protests in France over the presence of the Olympic torch, an internet campaign is underway in China to urge Chinese to boycott a French company. Carrefour is a French supermarket chain. It's big in China, but one online petition says the French people ignored the serious spirit of the torch and the feelings of the Chinese people. China, it said, cannot be insulted. And of course, a call for a boycott from China, no small thing. 1.3 billion potential consumers there. The torch proceeds to Islamabad, Pakistan tomorrow. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. How do you define jazz? In his new book, jazz critic Bob Blumenthal quotes Fats Waller, who said, "If you have to ask, you'll never know." But Bob goes on to ask anyway, is jazz Louis Armstrong? Some say yes. Is all jazz improvisational? Well, no. Is modern-day smooth jazz really anti-jazz? A lot of people think so. Do Kenny G and Benny Goodman have equal value? Don't get jazz musicians started on that one. Finally, Bob decided these aren't even the right questions. His book is called Jazz, An Introduction to the History and Legends Behind America's Music, and he joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Glad to be here, Robin.
So what is the right question?
Well, I think, first of all, if you try to talk about what jazz means, you have to stop and see when the question is being asked, because if you look at the first books that were written about jazz, they were written around 1940. So the great musicians that so many of us revere, the Miles Davises, Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, Keith Jarrett, not only these individuals, but the styles they were playing weren't even on the table for consideration at that point. Then once you have this kind of flexible definition, you can obviously bring in a lot of marginal music, if you will, marginal to the definition. So then the question to me becomes why so many styles of music would like to be considered jazz.
Right.
And I think it's really because the combination of spontaneity and teamwork that the music represents really stands for some ideals that go beyond music and touch on what we think of as America. And as America's art form, jazz really illustrates these points much better than many other parts of our culture.
Well, and it was easier to define it and see it in the early traditional days. There was, you know, we know the roots in Africa, then ragtime and Satchmo and swing and big bands and Glenn Miller. As you say, always changing, but was there a time when it changed and got more difficult to see?
I think that for the fans, it was always difficult to accept the change. And this is one of the constants of jazz history, that when a new style comes in, you have those who revered the existing approach, saying that's not really the right stuff.
Even like a Glenn Miller or Benny Goodman?
Even a Glenn Miller or a Benny Goodman. I mean, in the big band era, there were people who felt that real jazz was played by a 6- or 7-piece combo that looked like what we think of as the traditional New Orleans group, trumpet, trombone, clarinet, banjo, tuba, drums. So once you got into an orchestra, you were somehow watering down the real stuff. Then you find that after jazz in an orchestral setting becomes acceptable, the modern music that followed, which seemed very abstract compared to Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller, wasn't considered the real stuff by the big band fans. Then when we come to accept Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, and Miles Davis, Ornette Coleman seems out of bounds.
You mentioned Ornette Coleman. In 1959, he said his music was the shape of jazz to come.
I think that around 1960, when Coleman first gained his popularity, was a pivotal time, because jazz had been moving in a more abstract direction for about 20 years. The traditional rules were being bent and pulled out of shape, and the question was, would they be broken? Miles Davis, when he moved into jazz rock and electric music and introduced rhythms and just textures of sounds of electric guitars that were more common in popular music, all of these were expansions of the jazz bass. So the 1960s especially, I think, were a very volatile time for the definition of the music.
What are the different schools of jazz right now?
That's a tricky question, as tricky as always, maybe trickier, because whenever we draw a line or think we've drawn a reasonable line, you find examples that don't quite fit. So we could say, for instance, that you could divide jazz into the music played on acoustic instruments and the music played on electric instruments, with the electric stuff tending to be the more commercially acceptable, blending into the smooth jazz area. Then you get people like, particularly guitarists, John Scofield, Pat Metheny are good examples, that from recording to recording, as they change their bands, they may seem to fit more on one side than the other.
Pat Metheny has played with the classics. He's also played fusion. He's got this new trio CD out. These musicians refuse to be pinned down.
Pat Metheny is a great example. Dave Douglas is a great example. He has a band that is very clearly creating in the style that Miles Davis used in the early 1970s when he moved into the fusion area. Dave has another band where his trumpet is surrounded by an accordion, a violin, and a bass. Sounds completely different. It almost sounds like European cafe music, if such a thing exists. I also think that this notion of spontaneity and shared responsibility speaks a lot to what at least people in this country would like to think the country has always been about, and what the country represents to the world. I think I call jazz the sound image of freedom in countries that have lived under oppression. If you look back at the history of Eastern Europe under the Soviet Union, you see how many of the early movements away from Soviet domination had to do with music. In Czechoslovakia, it was a jazz club that led the way, and people listening to Frank Zappa records, which some of us might not think of as jazz, but had a lot of the same kind of improvised collective aspects to them. This is what drove a lot of political movements for freedom and reform around the world, and what many people see as the best aspect of this country. So I think the sense that if jazz is something unique to America, that it perhaps expresses the better aspects of what we would like to be, that also has a great amount of appeal to people.
And yet, you know, there's this perception, and people have said this to us preparing for this piece, that jazz is dead. You know, there's no real jazz radio. Smooth jazz, as you write, is considered anti-jazz by many devotees. And yet you said to us that, well, you know, not everyone plays Baroque music, but Baroque music is not dead. Do you think jazz is in the same category? Is it headed towards Baroque music, or what do you think it is?
Well, I think pronouncements about the death of any art form tend to be premature, because if the art form speaks to someone, it is not dead. Jazz is definitely not dead for those of us who respond to it and those who create it.
Bob Blumenthal, his new book is Jazz, An Introduction to the History and Legends Behind America's Music. It's a Smithsonian book, part of a series, and a remarkably short book for those who might be afraid of dipping their toe in for the first time. It's really concise and takes you through a lot of decades of music. Bob, thanks so much.
My pleasure.